Hello, this is World Business Report from the BBC World Service, where we bring you the latest in money, marketing, manufacturing, and yes, much, much more. Please review us, rate us, share us wherever you can. BBC podcasts are supported by advertising.
Hey guys, I'm Nadia.
And I'm Shabazz. We're just popping up with some essential news.
The brand new series of Doctor Who has begun.
And that means the official Doctor Who podcast is here.
Whether you're a Whovian or a Newvian, you are so welcome. This is the place where we dissect every episode, explain all the Easter eggs, and bring you some exclusive content too.
Plus, we'll have fabulous special guests and Doctor Who mega fans.
So come and find us. It's the official Doctor Who podcast.
Listen wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Hello and welcome to World Business Report from the BBC World Service. I'm Rahul Tandon. Plenty coming up on this programme, as always. It's the last weekend of campaigning in the South African elections. Unemployment is one of the main issues. We'll hear from voters.
We are a very unequal society, but one doesn't expect the present government to have cured everything within 30 years.
Yeah. And we're going to hear from the former president of Costa Rica. But we're going to begin the programme by talking once again about what is happening in Ukraine. The US Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen has urged G7 ministers who are meeting as we speak in Italy to consider using more ambitious options to use frozen assets to help Ukraine's finances. Speaking to reporters at the summit, the German finance minister, Christian Lindner, said some progress had been made.
We have now found a way that is legally secure and at the same time mobilizes additional support for Ukraine. Further ambitions are being discussed. There are proposals on the table to generate additional funds from the proceeds in the form of leverage.
It's a story that we've been talking about, haven't we, all week on our program. So we thought it would be a good time to look at the state of the Ukrainian economy. Firstly, let's bring in Timothy Milovanov, president of the Kyiv School of Economics and former Minister of Economic Development, Trade and Agriculture of Ukraine, a familiar voice on the program. Thanks for joining us once
Thank
again.
You.
Can you give us a sense of how much money Ukraine needs to basically rebuild its infrastructure and its economy?
Well, there are multiple estimates. There are direct losses from the war, that direct damages, what has been destroyed, that's about $150 billion. And it's growing by, you know, by day, actually. There is a World Bank estimate on what would mean or how much funding is needed to bring Ukraine to sort of the same trajectory it would have been without the war. And that's in $400-500 billion range.
Can I ask you, there's a lot of talk about Russian assets. Do you look at the situation at the moment and see that there is enough money that's going to come to Ukraine to give the sort of money that you're talking about?
Well, so there are at least $300 billion plus Russian immobilized assets. And it's only fair that it is the Russian assets which are used to pay for recovery and support to Ukraine, rather than taxpayers' money of whatever country. You know, it's great that people are willing to help, and people from around the world, essentially, you know, everyone has paid their taxes to support Ukraine. But it's much more important, I think, and much more fair and just to get Russia funds. And it's enough. I mean, of course, that's not going to be the end of it. And it depends on how longer the war continues and how much more damage Russia inflicts. But that's a substantive amount of funds.
Timothy, stay with us because I want you to listen to this interview that we did a short time ago, because we wanted to get a sense of what it is like to be running a business in Ukraine at the moment. Vodovits Alexander is a senior executive with Met Invest Group. They're one of the largest investors in Ukraine, and he's based in Kyiv.
The biggest problems is people, because a lot of people has migrated and a lot of people are abroad. Another problem is that a lot of people are in the army, and the recruitment system took majority of men from our company, for example. And not the majority, but let's say a big portion of workers, mainly male workers, are already on the front line. And we have some specialties when we can't attract people for our work because people are hiding. people don't want to have official work because the militaries will find them and will take them to the war. That is why they're afraid. This is the biggest problem, and this is a bottleneck right now to increase production, to increase earnings, to increase everything. Second problem, I would say investment and currency control. We heard a lot of stories when a lot of different foreign investors want to come to Ukraine with the help of European Union and United States. They want to invest. But the main question, and the only one question when they ask us, is how we will get our money to be paid back. Because right now, on the legislative level, it's forbidden to pay any currency outside of Ukraine. So no one will invest in Ukraine knowing that there is no permission to repay money.
You obviously had a new law passed recently, which means we could see more people being conscripted. I presume that makes your life even harder as you're trying to run a business.
Yeah, this new law, which was accepted, has made a significant impact on our business. Why? Because, for example, as of today, no one from our company cannot go out abroad. We have international meetings. We have planned meetings with our suppliers, with our creditors, with our clients. We stopped everything because no one is allowed to go outside of Ukraine. Why? Because there are a lot of discrepancies in the procedures. Militaries are saying one thing, customs authorities saying another things, and they don't allow people to go abroad. They just took them from the train, they just took out them from cars and saying, we will not allow you to cross the border. This new law is complete mess for all companies who have official workers.
We hear a lot, don't we, about the help Ukraine needs militarily in terms of finances. I presume you need a lot of money to rebuild the infrastructure that you need to make businesses work in the country and help businesses work in the country.
It depends what we will name as infrastructure. If, for example, we are saying about the roads, yeah, roads are more or less in a good shape. Railway is also more or less. Ports, they are attacked every time, but ports are protected somehow and they are functioning right now. But if you are talking about the electricity, it's a total mess. We partially stop our steel plants in Zaporozhye and in Kaminskoye. It's second and third biggest plants in Ukraine. We stop them from time to time because we don't have electricity. And when our government is saying to international partners that we need money to rebuild this electrical infrastructure, I think there are some problems with conversation with our partners because they don't want to give money to private sector. They don't want to give money to private companies. And this is a problem.
Metinvest is one of the biggest companies in Ukraine. You're there in steel and mining, aren't you? How is business nowadays? How are you doing inside Ukraine?
Everything is in comparison. If we will take the time at the beginning of the war, we thought that everything is over and we will stop our business. Everybody don't know what will happen next. As of today, people get accustomed to war. It's unfortunately, but people get accustomed. And we know that we have responsibility in front of our people. We know that we need to continue to work. We continue to pay taxes in full scale. And I would say it's better than it was at the beginning of the war. But we are not speaking about the development of the business, of increasing of production. We are speaking about the survival. Can we survive right now? I would say yes. Somehow we survive. But I'm not very confident in the future.
Timothy Milovanov is still with us. Interesting to hear that executive from the Meta Invest Group, Timothy. We talk a lot about Russian funding and using those assets. How much private investment is coming into Ukraine? Is there a lot of coming in from that sector?
Yeah, so the executive talked about the capital controls, but that's a standard policy during crisis. And in part, it has been imposed by the IMF program. And it's a condition for stabilization of the economy. So, of course, businesses are being hurt by that in the short run. But in the longer run, capital controls will be will be relieved. What we have seen that companies, foreign companies, which are already in Ukraine, they continue to invest. They sort of feel the obligation and they understand the risks and they have a lot of moral support, but also they're building up. But if we're talking about new investments, that's a problem. That's difficult. And I think, realistically, until the war comes to an end or there is some de facto armistice or peace, the investments will not follow. So, you know, that's the problem, yes.
Shanti Kellerman is with the Chief Investment Officer at M&G Wealth. We've talked a lot about Ukraine over the last few years. Huge impact on the global economy initially when it came to food and gas prices. That impact lessening, though, as the war goes on.
Yeah, it has lessened. I think food prices are still higher than they were 2 years ago. So that impact is still there, but the rate of change is a lot lower. A lot of the gas prices have come down significantly. So I would say today it's not really a big impact on the global economy, but it, you know, it obviously impacts some of the neighboring countries a lot more. I think one of the other things people will look at is what's the investment opportunity to rebuild Ukraine? Because once governments do start putting money behind it, there will be a lot of opportunities for private companies to rebuild a lot of infrastructure, but it's probably too soon to look at some of those.
Timothy, final word to you. 30 seconds, I'm afraid that's all you've got. But what is the number one problem facing Ukrainian businesses at the moment? Investment? Workers?
Well, I'd say it's workers. But it's the war, really. I mean, we can get by. We're pretty resilient. And of course, the war is painful and hurting. But we need the war to stop, and then we will rebuild.
Timothy, always a pleasure having you on the program there. Thank you so much for joining us from Kyiv.
Hey guys, I'm Nadia.
And I'm Shabazz. We're just popping up with some essential news.
The brand new series of Doctor Who has begun.
And that means the official Doctor Who podcast is here.
Whether you're a Whovian or a Nuvian, you are so welcome. This is the place where we dissect every episode, explain all the Easter eggs, and bring you some exclusive content too.
Plus, we'll have fabulous special guests and Doctor Who mega fans.
So come and find us. It's the official Doctor Who podcast.
Listen wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
You're with World Business Report from the BBC World Service. Let's move from Europe to the US now.
Tomorrow he'll play in a game that'll gross over $500 million. But Emmett won't see a dime. And just like the other 12,000 draft eligible players that don't make the NFL every year, his football days will be over.
That was part of the trailer for the 2021 film National Champions, which is about a college football player's strike in order to fight for fair compensation. The film may be fiction, but it does mirror real life, as despite attracting huge audiences, college athletes in the US, well, they're not getting paid directly. But could that be about to change? The National Collegiate Athletic Association, which governs university sports in the country, has reached a deal that could lead to that happening. George Elks is a lawyer who's brought a case on behalf of a college student in Colorado. He's been telling me how the current system works.
Traditionally, the only compensation they get is in the form of scholarships and some benefits. That started to change a couple of years ago. Compensation was available for name, image, and likeness issues.
So when we look at college sports, it's important to note here, isn't it, that whilst it is seen to be sports played by amateurs, there's actually a lot of revenue being generated when it comes to TV revenue. This is big business, isn't it?
Absolutely. And one of the things that's interesting is when you talk to older people, their reaction is, well, why should athletes at a college where they're getting an education and they're getting scholarships receive additional compensation? Having been a former athlete in college myself, when you're playing at the major school level, it's a full-time job. And in many ways, you're disadvantaged in terms of the opportunities that students that are not burdened with the commitments that you have to make as an athlete have in terms of their academic work, graduation opportunities afterwards, that sort of thing. So it's absolutely a full-time job, and they should be viewed as employees.
Give us an idea of what sort of revenues, and give us an idea of the level of interest there are in college sports.
it's not unusual for college football in the United States and college basketball, both men's and women's basketball, to garner the kind of television viewing that's greater than the professional sports are on occasion.
Can you tell us where we are in the legal process here? Because we have a number of college students who are saying, look, we're entitled to some of the revenue money. We've seen another significant development in the last few days. Where are we overall legally here?
What's triggered the current settlement proposal is the fact that in one of the, what I refer to as the name, image, likeness cases, it's called the House case, that is scheduled to go to trial in January of next year. And the NCAA does not want to go to trial in front of a jury. The terms of the settlement and the proposal have not been filed with the court yet. What's available to the public is basically information that's been leaked to the media.
It looks, doesn't it? And we are still some way to go here, that there could be a settlement involving billions of dollars that could go to hundreds of college athletes. So are we looking at the end of amateurism in college sport?
I certainly believe if you view the concept of student employee athletes being compensated and being entitled to a percentage or portion of the revenue that they generate, as you know, I call them content creators, the same way people in the entertainment business are referred to. Yes, I think those days are over. Keep in mind that top level coaches in men's football are being compensated at the level of in excess of $10 million. And so when people pause and say, well, why should an athlete receive any money? You know, they're getting a scholarship. My reaction is, why should a college football coach receive $10 million or more?
Okay.
You know, it just becomes a negotiation.
Well, it becomes a negotiation, but should they get less than what a professional gets in terms of that percentage of revenues? Because they are getting something else with it, which is a college education, which is pretty expensive in the U.S.
It's a fair question. It depends upon what kind of revenue they're generating for their employer. If you're talking about a professional athlete whose sport generates $1 million versus a college sport that generates billions of dollars, the idea that the college athlete, the content creator, should get more than the professional in that comparison, it shouldn't surprise anybody. It depends upon the value that you're bringing to the table.
Don't college athletes then, though, get the benefits when they become professional athletes? You know, if you are performing well at the college level, the contracts you're going to get afterwards are huge. So you are getting money, aren't you?
Rahul, here's the thing you have to keep in mind. A very tiny, tiny percentage of college athletes ever go forward at the professional level. The vast majority of them are looking for employment in regular markets the way you and I did after college.
George Delstan, that is a story that we will continue to keep an eye on. Let's continue our journey around the different continents, head to Africa now, South Africa, where it's the last weekend of rallying before voters head to the polls. One of the big issues for them is the country's eye-watering unemployment levels.
I'm hoping to get a job, any job, because I'm desperate.
I'm 27 years old. Way too many people are sitting at home without jobs, including graduates. It's also not easy to start a business because we do not have the money for it. Many live with their grandparents and rely on grants. Unemployment is too high.
It's very bad because I'm the breadwinner, so we don't know what we're going to do. So we are struggling.
Unemployment, clearly a big issue. Let's hear from some voters.
We don't feel as if we have the freedom that we need to have. There's a whole lot of corruption happening. As a human being living here, I feel oppressed by my government.
I think the politicians, they took advantage because we were happy.
We are a very unequal society. But one doesn't expect the present government to have cured everything within 30 years.
Yeah. I should vote because I must have a voice tomorrow. The devil you know, it's better than the devil that you don't know.
Some voters there. Well, businesses are watching the election closely. If you listen to World Business Report, we talk a lot, don't we, about the power cuts that many of them are having to face, as well as logistical issues at some of the ports in the country. I've been speaking to Jaap van der Linde, an analyst at Oxford Economics, he's based in Cape Town, about the state of the country's economy and what voters are weighing up before casting their vote.
Post-pandemic, the recovery has been quite slow. So basically, you know, the South African economy is is at about pre-pandemic levels. So the economy is stagnating. And the ANC government hasn't really been able to, you know, lift economic growth and improve the living conditions and the livelihoods of most South Africans leading into this election.
What are the other parties that are contesting, and what sort of economic policies are they putting forward that maybe differ from the traditional policies of the ANC?
If the ANC share of the vote drops to, let's say, around 40%, it must then, you know, make a deal with one of the two main opposition parties, which is, you know, either the Economic Freedom Fighters or the Democratic Alliance. In terms of the former, that would perhaps, scare many investors. They're likely to see a negative market reaction if, you know, the ANC and the DA, which is the opposition party in this instance, would go into a coalition. It might be more business friendly, but, you know, ultimately foes are joining hands, and that in itself is creates a lot of uncertainty.
You mentioned that the Economic Freedom Party may scare away some investors because some of the policies they're putting forward, but because unemployment is such a big problem and has been such a big problem for a long time in South Africa, do you think some voters are looking for new answers, new policies, something a lot more radical than we've seen in the past?
I think that is something that, you know, a lot of people are concerned about, and, you know, rightfully so. I mean, South Africans are becoming increasingly desperate because living conditions have become worse. And the EFF is making fanciful promises that appeal to people that might be desperate. That's ultimately what's so unique about these elections. There are so many uncertainties, and no one can really say for sure what might happen.
Let's bring in Shanti Kellerman back here. We had an announcement, didn't we, about an election here in the UK that will take place in July. Many elections taking place across the world. The economy, often the central issue for many people, and people poring over data as they go to vote.
Yeah, it will have a huge impact. South Africa in markets is kind of the biggest market that foreign investors would invest in within Africa. So it's also kind of important in that continent as sort of the most stable. But if you look at what they're, you know, what you get on their government bonds, a lot of them pay more than 10% yield. So it shows you that there's a lot of worries internationally about the stability of the country and the ability to, eventually repay its debt.
Stay with us, because we're going to talk about another election now, and we're going to look at Mexico, which goes to the polls next weekend. The winner is almost certainly going to be a woman. The two front runners are both women. My colleague Gideon Long, who sat here in the studio with us, has been looking at Latin America all this week for our Business Daily program. He's been a very good listener as well. He's been talking to a woman who was the first female president of her country and one of the first in Latin America, Costa Rica's Laura Chinchilla.
When I was a child, it was impossible to imagine a woman as president because at that time there were no women presidents. But I decided to follow a public service career, and that is why I started moving to politics. Becoming the first female president of my country was the greatest honor of my life, but also a challenge due to prevailing sexist views. Now we already have 50% of women's representation in our National Assembly, and that is good news.
And you were part of a wave of female presidents in the region, Michelle Bachelet in Chile, Cristina Fernandez in Argentina, Dilma Rousseff in Brazil. Did it feel like a significant moment, a period when women had finally made it to some of the top jobs in the region?
Yes, it was a significant moment, and I remember how easy it was for us to coordinate certain kind of policies. We needed to wait for many years, and hopefully we will have a new women president in Mexico, and that is going to be very, very important, not only for that country, but also for the rest of Latin America, because having a female president in the second largest democracy in Latin America will certainly resonate with many young women.
Yeah, those Mexican elections are on the horizon now, and the two leading candidates in the election, both women.
Yes, and I will be there. I was invited, and I will go.
And how do you see the relationship between Latin America and the United States developing? And I'm thinking here about the fact that the US has an election on the horizon.
Unfortunately, the relationship between Latin America and the United States right now is highly conditioned by the geopolitical tensions between China and the United States. It seems that the United States is more concerned about the presence of China in many countries in Latin America rather than trying to counterbalance that presence. That is particularly true with the countries in South America, where China has become the most important trade and, in some cases, investment partner.
Gideon is in the studio with us now. Fascinating to hear from the former Costa Rican president. On that question you posed about the US and its relationship economically with Latin America, in spite of China coming into many countries, the US still the main player?
Well, still the main player, but it doesn't have as much of an eye on Latin America as it used to. In fact, you know, it used to be the case that many Latin Americans criticized the North Americans for their intervention in the region, and that was certainly the case if you go back to the 60s and 70s. It's much less the case now. And actually, one of the criticisms that Latin America makes is that that North America and the United States have kind of taken their eye off the ball, and they're more concerned about other parts of the world, like China, like Ukraine, like the Middle East, and they're not paying enough attention to Latin America.
You've looked at lots of different themes during the course of this week. You're somebody who's lived in the region for a long period of time. You know it. But often when you put pieces together like that, you surprise yourself. You learn things yourself. What stood out for you? What suddenly struck you from the work that you've put in there? And it's been a lot of work.
You do learn things yourself, and also you remind yourself of things. So this is something which I guess I already knew, but I reminded myself of it while I was putting the series together. And that is that you can't really talk about Latin America as one entity. Obviously, lots of similarities in terms of history and languages, but the differences between some of those economies is vast. The difference between the Argentine economy and the Brazilian economy are huge. The difference between the Chilean and the Mexican economy are massive. So you can, to some extent, talk about Latin America as one entity, but only to some extent.
Gideon, thank you very much for joining us. You can hear Gideon's full interview on BBC Sounds, and also you can go back and listen to the rest of the series as well. Shanti Kellerman still with us. We've talked about elections. Let's end on elections. Of course, we now know that there will be an election here in the UK. Surprised many people. Did it surprise the markets? How have they reacted over the last couple of days?
The market reaction has been fairly muted. I think because there's such a wide gap in the poll, the market is kind of already priced in what that outcome is going to be. And also because there's so many constraints on whoever the next government is in terms of the deficits, the funding they want to do, the spending, there's not a huge amount of difference in the policies. So I think you'll probably see it's probably good to bring it forward because we'll get certainty sooner. But I think the market's probably already priced in a lot of the outcomes they're expecting.
Shanti, thank you for all your contributions during the program. I hope you have a good weekend, as we talked about there. South Africa, Mexico, elections coming up next week on our Business Matters program. We're going to take a little bit of a closer look at what's going on in the US, a close look at some of the issues that voters are beginning to consider there. Of course, elections still taking place in India, so we're going to keep talking about them. But that is it for this edition of World Business Report.
This is the BBC World Service. And on The Inquiry this week...
I'm Charmaine Cozier. An armed uprising against military leadership is in its third year. Thousands of people have died, millions have been forced from their homes, the economy is broken, and there's no end in sight. Is Myanmar on the brink of collapse?
The Inquiry at bbcworldservice.com/inquiry. At bbcworldservice.com, assignment.
I'm Antonia Bolingbroke-Kent, and I've come to Kazakhstan to find out why the Caspian Sea, the world's largest inland body of water, is shrinking at unprecedented speed. As water levels fall, I ask what impact this is having on the people and ecology of the region.
This is the BBC World Service, the world's radio station.
Hey.
Hey guys, I'm Nadia.
And I'm Shabazz. We're just popping up with some essential news.
The brand new series of Doctor Who has begun.
And that means the official Doctor Who podcast is here.
Whether you're a Whovian or a Newvian, you are so welcome. This is the place where we dissect every episode, explain all the Easter eggs, and bring you some exclusive content too.
Plus, we'll have fabulous special guests and Doctor Who mega fans.
So come and find us. It's the official Doctor Who podcast.
Listen wherever you get your BBC podcasts.